Hi, everyone. My name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to AA for being sober today. Thanks, everyone, for coming to the meeting. I always start my shares with a line in the big book because that basically describes my alcoholism. Alcohol gave me wings to fly, and then alcohol took away the sky. I had a love affair with the beverage, and I was a periodic. I used to drink on the weekends, and then it moved up during college and started on Wednesday night and went to Sunday night. So I guess you could say I became a daily drinker pretty much. Besides definitely removing the phenomenon of craving and being able to be comfortable in my own skin, I think the greatest gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is the power of now, to live in the moment, to live in the present, and to not live in guilt of the past and fear of the future. So I'm going to just share a little bit what it's like now, because that's what's most important to me today. I guess I should be honest and change my name from, well, the location to Los Angeles, because as of Thursday of last week, I gave 30 days notice to my landlord, and last Thursday, I left Santa Barbara. I could not find a place in 30 days. Some of the ads are wanted: Christian female, full-time job, early 20s, maybe 30s. Well, I'm an atheist. I don't have a full-time job. I'm 60. And I don't exactly qualify for a lot of the ads. I'm going to keep looking, keep doing the footwork. I'm staying with my sister and her husband in Los Angeles, and I'll revisit my relationship with her a little later. And last week, Thursday, I had arranged with people. Alcoholics Anonymous can help people in so many different ways. So I called up this sober living house called All Star. And I said, I need a couple guys to help me move some furniture and a futon. I don't know, man, 300-pound futon's pretty heavy. And this guy said, let me check around. And sure enough, this guy called me and he said he'd be there at 11 on Thursday. Sorry, 10 o'clock on Thursday. Well, at 10:10, I called him and he's got 90 days of sobriety. And he goes, oh shit, I forgot. I'm having a haircut, but I'll be there at 11. And he came at 11. I was told he was bringing a truck. He didn't bring a truck. I was very fortunate that my sister lent me her SUV. So he put the stuff in the SUV, and then he had to leave. He had to go to a doctor's appointment. So I had to go to this recycling dump place, which was really trippy. I mean, all these trucks go in there and these bulldozers, and they're watering down the dust, and you just throw all your stuff into a pile. I mean, this pile is, I don't know, it could be 10, 15 feet high and 20, 30 yards long. And I did all that, it was very difficult. I was concerned I'd done permanent damage to my back, but it's healing. But I don't deal with stress very well, or I internalize stress, let's put it this way. And it just so happened on Thursday, I got what I thought was a spider bite on my left elbow. Okay, life goes on. The next day, on Thursday, the day I'm doing the whole moving, I got another spider bite on my right elbow. I'm like, nah, spiders aren't that smart. That's too much of a coincidence. And now I'm looking at about, I don't know, 8 rashes on my knees and my arms. And that's an actual condition that's caused by stress. So, you know, my arms are burning and I'm doing all this moving stuff. And it was one of the hardest days of my life, but I just had to like break it down into hours and just do everything that I had to do. I mean, I dropped some stuff off at somebody's house, drove back 20 miles, and then I had to realize that I had to like disassemble a desk. So I had to drive back to go get my screwdriver, you know, just life on life's terms, difficult things that I had to take care of. And so I moved a lot of my things to my sister's house, and I'm in Los Angeles. It's not Santa Barbara, but you know, I'm not homeless. I have a you know, a beautiful bed and a very nice house that I'm living in. So I should not be complaining at all. So, you know, everybody's got his story, her story. I got my story. So I'll just start at the beginning and just go through a few things, what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. I was born in South Africa in 1962. I lived there for the first 15 years of my life. I learned one major emotion in retrospect, and that was from my parents. I learned the emotion of fear, you know, and it certainly was not false evidence appearing real. It was real evidence, fearful. My parents, you know, from probably the age of 5, told me that there's going to be a race war, and that they were, and by extension, I became very fearful of Black people, even though we had a gardener who lived in a room off our house, and a maid. And then also on top of that, I had to fear my parents, because especially my mother. My mother was a child abuser. I found that out one day when I came to America and I was watching Phil Donahue, and they had this program about child abuse, and I go, that's me. She would hit me with anything and everything she'd get her hands on. I had to do things perfectly, or there was going to be consequences, punishment. I spent a lot of time in my room, because I was sent to my room like for 4 hours, for 6 hours, and learned how to, I guess, just entertain myself in my own mind. And I did a lot of reading. My father, he was a smart man. He went to Harvard. He got an MBA, but he certainly did not wear the pants in the family. He was a good analyst, and he had a little poem that he taught me when I was young, and it went like this: good, better, best, never shall I rest till my good is better and my better best. So perfection was basically the standard in our house. And I used to tell people, you know, in my family, an A is average, a B is bad, and a C is crap. And I used to measure my self-worth by whether I got A's or B's or C's. And C's were not acceptable. They really weren't. So, the one story I want to tell about living in South Africa was, which is something that only during Zoom have I actually been sharing about it and come to terms about it. It was never discussed. One day we went to see a play at the high school, and I was about 12 years old, and we had a big house with a 6-foot, 8-foot wall with glass that was put on top of the wall, pieces of cut glass so people couldn't get in. But I don't know, the gate was not locked. It wasn't a gate, it was a big wooden door was not locked. And we walked up maybe about 50 yards in the garden and then came to the front door, which was wide open. And my father had an office like with French windows and they were all smashed out. And we just stood like deer in the headlights. And then this guy ran out the house and he had about 10 or 12 of my father's suits on his one shoulder. And he had a clock that my father had gotten on a business trip to Zurich in Switzerland. And he also just stood there like frozen. And, you know, fear, fuck everything and run. There was my mother, my father, and my sister. And my father like picked up one of like the pool chairs. And I just ran. I ran to the neighbor's house and told them what had happened. But I was, you know, after that, I was very ashamed that I'd left my family just standing there. Thankfully, nothing happened to them because the guy just dropped everything and ran. And when talking to my sister afterwards, she said he couldn't have been more than 19 or 20 years old. We were lucky. My aunt, she came home with her four kids in a SUV and like opened the driveway. And before she was able to close it, these guys came in and they had guns and they told the family to get out of the SUV, which they did, and they drove away. But They shot my aunt and she died. So there's a little story to this, you know. So her widower husband was left with four kids. And then I guess maybe about a year later, he met a woman who had four kids. And so they were on the front, who was also a widower. And so they were on the front of the South African newspaper and it said, eight is enough, you know, because they joined and they got married. But so we left South Africa in 1977 because I would have had to go to the army and my parents did not want me to go to the army, which was extremely difficult. And plus my parents did not want me to fight for South Africa. They were against apartheid. And so we came to America, which for me was like going from, you know, Sunday school to Disneyland. I mean, it was just amazing how much freedom I found in this country. They wanted me to have a very good education. So we got a small apartment in Beverly Hills and I went to what I call Beverly Hills Get High School because there was amazing amount of drugs and alcohol, you know, done by the students in that school. And I got on the tennis team. On my book bag, I had written, tennis isn't a matter of life and death. It's much more important than that. And winning was super important to me. I judge my inner self, my self-worth by whether I won or I lost. And I'd go into terrible depressions when I lost matches. One day coming back from a town about 35, 40 miles from LA called Agoura, on the bus, somebody lit a joint. I smoked it and I was off to the races. I'd also started drinking Michelob because there was an ad, you know, Michelob is made for the weekends. And I loved the effect of alcohol. It, it made me, there's a guy in Santa Barbara and he's got this, this expression and it's kind of, it's ironic that I'm saying this in a agnostic atheist meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said alcohol reminded him of as if it was a warm hug from God. And alcohol became my higher power, no question about it. You know, I could never control my drinking. The third beer wanted a fourth beer, and the seventh beer wanted an eighth beer. And then I found out that I didn't have to drink as much. And I so enjoyed 151 rum, Johnny Walker, Jack Daniels whiskey, and I guess now that I think about it, my most favorite hard alcohol was tequila, because I used to be able to go no matter what to happy hours, you know, it's not like 3-4 times a week, and food was free, so you got to eat a lot of, you know, I got to eat a meal and then pay and then buy alcohol. And just drink pitchers of margaritas. You know, I blacked out when I was drinking. And one of the most shameful events in my life was blacking out one night. I was probably around 21, still living at home with my parents. I think I'd actually been kicked out of this dorm that I was living in for drinking too much and you know, causing mischief. So I blacked out, and the next thing I see is my parents turning on the light in my room, and I'm urinating in the corner. And I just like looked at them and the shock on their face. And I just said, I couldn't find the light switch. That to me seemed like a good enough reason. My parents, my mother brought me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, after I went to a psychiatrist, and, you know, my father used to drink. He used to drink, 2, max 3 drinks a night, every night. He was a very controlled person. I just, when I went to the psychiatrist, I said, well, I just drink like 21 shots on the weekend. What's the difference? He drinks 21 shots a week. And they were like saying, no, you can't do that. And, you know, there's certain consequences for blacking out and throwing up. I used to throw up as well, but that didn't bother me. I just thought it was par, you know, par for the course, one of the side effects. And, so they took me to a meeting, and I remember it like it was yesterday, because on the way home, I jumped out of my mother's moving car, and I kid you not, there was a bus coming, and if I had tripped, I would not be speaking tonight. It was very reckless what I did, but I just thought at that moment that my life was over, because in the meeting they had given people cakes. They had birthday cakes for years of sobriety. Well, in South Africa, if you took a cake for more than, if you got a birthday cake after you were 12 years old, you know, you were a sissy, I guess, is another word that I could use, but I'm not going to. So, you know, I didn't get it. I didn't understand how important, how difficult it is for someone to get a year of sobriety, for someone to get, you know, a cake for 5 years, 10 years. But I certainly learned subsequently. So, I grudgingly started going to meetings. I went to this group in about 3 miles from my house in Brentwood, California, called the Pacific Group. And I had long hair and a beard. And at that meeting, they had rules. And one of the rules is you're supposed to be clean shaven. They had quite a lot of other rules, you know, like women who went up to the podium to share had to wear dresses. Men had to wear a coat and tie. Look, the meeting gets 700 people every week. And the meeting was run by a gentleman named Clancy, who was renowned in certainly in American AA. And, you know, I listened to phenomenal speakers, I was 22 and I just thought that, you know, I wasn't willing to do the work. I was so shut down emotionally and, I didn't trust anyone. And there again, you know, I came from South Africa, which had so many rules, draconian rules for things you can do, things you couldn't do. And so it was very difficult for me. And I didn't stay with that group for long. I moved on to the West Side Ulano Club, which was very cool because the people there were different, and they talked about doing fives, doing dimes and nickels and dimes. And I was like, what is that? And they go, 5 years in jail, 10 years in jail. They had a lot of tattoos, and they cursed a lot. You know, I hadn't done any of those, but they accepted me. And that became my home group for quite a while. I did meet a woman at the West Side Ulano Club, and she was sharing from the podium. You had to walk up. This was a long room, maybe fit 40 people at the most, I would say. You'd have to walk up to a podium, and you'd share from the podium, and had a microphone and everything. And this woman walked up there, and she shared that she used to do tricks. She was a hooker. She was a prostitute on Hollywood and in Hollywood and Vine in Los Angeles. And she said, "I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not proud of it. That was then, and this is now." And I just and she was like, just. She had such a like a beautiful face, and her eyes were wide open. And I just couldn't believe somebody could say that from the podium, you know. And I was starting to do the steps, and I got to page 69, and talks about doing a sexual inventory. And I just asked her if I could do it with her, and she said yes. And then after I did that, she said, it was kind of funny. She goes, "You know, you're not going to ever sleep with me." And I was like, "Yeah, I know, I know." And so she said, "I think now it's time for you to get a male sponsor." And I did. And, you know, I worked the steps in order, and they certainly transformed me. I don't think that I'm the person today that I was then. I used to think that the, you know, the world owed me. I used to think that I was the center of the universe, and I certainly don't think that today. With regards to, you know, humility, I don't have to think less of myself, but I do think about myself less today. I really like the line in the Big Book on page 20. It's amazing. I only found it, you know, a couple years ago. I mean, it was always there, and it talks about being, it says, you know, being an ex-problem drinker. I'm an ex-problem drinker because the problem of drinking has been removed for decades. So it goes, being an ex-problem drinker, our very lives depend on the constant thought of others and how we can help them meet their needs. And that has really helped me in the last couple of years, no question about it. You know, and that ties into to being of service, to you know, when asked to speak or to help somebody, to just to say yes, you know, as much as possible. There are times when it's an exception, but you know, the I really like the Declaration of Responsibility, which you know, states, when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that I am responsible. So, you know, I'm just going to go back and say that, you know, in early AA, they always talked about how my ego had to be smashed. But there's some people in AA, and I think I'm definitely one of them, whose ego was smashed already and needed to be built up. Because, you know, my mother always used to say to me that I'm, you know, you're a mess. You know, you're a piece of shit. I mean, it didn't do good, very good for oneself. Demeanor and self-worth. But yeah, you know, I think it's important to have a healthy ego, but not to control people. It just reminds me of a story of this guy. His name was Danny, and you know, he led a meeting on Friday nights in Westlake Village. About 300 people used to come, and he had been like, you know, he would kind of like handpick who would be the next secretary, or he would work it out so that this person got elected. And this other thing that he did was he would blow this shell to start the meeting. I don't know why, it was just his thing. And then some other, you know, people with a lot of time came up to him and said, you know, listen, we're doing away with the shell. We don't want you blowing it anymore. And he had been coming to that meeting every week for seven years, you know, once a week for 7 years. And when he was told that, he never came back to the meeting. So, you know, I've just learned to be, to hopefully just be a worker among workers, and to be right-sized. Alcoholics Anonymous definitely has taught me that. I have to remember right now, you know, I'm living in my sister's house with her husband, and my father really, really liked him because he's super successful attorney. You know, they've got four kinds of olive oil in their kitchen cabinet. I don't, you know, four kinds of olive oil. It's kind of strange, but, so, you know, I've at times judged my insides with his outsides. I mean, you know, this guy probably makes, I'm trying to work it out, but yeah, probably, you know, like in a week, he definitely makes in a month what I used to make in 6 months. So, you know, he's a very wealthy guy. And anyway, he deserves it. He did the work, and he's got the clients, and he's done the footwork. You know, I wanted to touch on sponsorship for a little bit, because like I was telling you, I did my sexual inventory with a woman, and then I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps, and the sponsor that I got, he was sponsoring maybe about 10, 15 other people. And when I was at his house, the phone would ring constantly, and he was always doing service work. And I used to think that used to be the goal, to be like Gaston, my sponsor. He passed away just short of his 41st birthday in AA about 10 years ago. And, you know, everybody's got their story, everybody's got their situation, and everything's relative, because I, you know, he was like the man of Thousand Oaks. Everybody knew Gaston, everybody went to him with problems regarding, you know, how to work steps and things. And he never told me, you know, I didn't know that much about his story until one day he actually came up to Santa Barbara to speak at a meeting. And he was telling the story about when he was in his mid-20s, and he was driving his car, and you know, he used to hide bottles everywhere, and he hid one under the seat of his car. And he came to a stop sign, and it was he found it necessary to have a swig of the alcohol. And so he reached underneath the seat to get the bottle, and his foot went from the brake to the acceleration, and he killed a 12-year-old little boy. So that's his story. I didn't kill anybody. Okay. I was in one fight in my life and I lost. But now I understood why he had to do what he had to do. You know, that was his living amends to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the world, you know. And one other thing that was really amazing about him that I never knew until I knew it, you know, I used to go to his house all the time and we'd sit in the living room and stuff. And then one day he asked me to go get something from his room, and I went into his room, and it was, you know, he was from Ecuador, and his father was very high up in politics. And on the wall in his room was a cross, and on the cross was this man. And I was like, I couldn't believe that he was like such a devout Catholic Christian, you know, but live and learn. Yeah, he was a great guy, and he helped a lot of people. So I just wanted to share, probably last, is, you know, I've had the opportunity and the privilege of sponsoring a few people, not hundreds by any means, probably, you know, 10, 15, some say sober, some didn't. But to hear somebody read a fourth step to you, you know, to do the fifth with somebody is what I call, you know, one of the most spiritual events of my life. You know, I don't know really what spirituality is today, except the most spiritual thing I can ever do is not take the first drink. And I had a lot of service commitments. At 27 years of sobriety in 2014, a lot of events happened in that year which were quite fortuitous to me. I do not call them miraculous. Number one is I started reading a lot about Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris. And I was sitting at my computer one day and I said out loud, there is no God. And I'd always had a dilemma in my mind. There was a lot of cognitive dissonance about like how I pray and something comes true for me, or good things happen in my life, my higher power's working. But, you know, why do 25,000 people die every day from hunger? You know, why are people born deformed? And probably the most personal thing that, you know, is like, I don't know if I was born with it or it manifested later in my life, but I know for a fact that I'm a double trudger. I do have bipolar disorder, bipolar one. Twice in my life, this was, thank goodness, you know, back when I was in my early 20s, I basically didn't move from a bed or a room for 3 months. And I lost a tremendous amount of weight, and I had there was no pleasure in my life at all. It was there's a book called A Holiday of Darkness, and no question about it. And then mania is wicked too, because I've, not slept for 3 weeks, you know, had to be hospitalized in 1984 and also again in 1987. 1987 was the worst because I had been going to the West Side Alano Club, and I'd had a couple years of sobriety, and I stopped taking my meds, and I ended up in a mental hospital. And the doctor said to me, and I was totally psychotic, and the doctor said to me, you know, I don't think you're clean and sober, so we're going to do a urine test, a blood test. They both came back negative. And he goes, well, Jeff, now you've got a bigger problem, because it's in your mind. It's in your, you have a chemical imbalance, and you have to go back on your meds. And I listened to this guy because he had 12 years of sobriety. And so I digress for a minute there. So, yeah, I was talking about, so, you know, I don't know why any kind of higher power would create any illness, but, you know, I mean, COVID, I mean, you know, but bipolar is, it's wicked. That's all I can say about it from my personal experience. You know, I wouldn't wish it on my kids. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. So I was sitting at my computer and I read this article, Why Doesn't God Heal Amputees? And I said out loud, there is no God. And I really, at that moment, was thinking to myself, how am I going to now navigate Alcoholics Anonymous? And the next day, I went for the rest of that day, I felt like I was on a roller coaster going downhill with no end. And the next day, I went to the market, and sure enough, there was Jerry. Jerry had 38 years of sobriety, and I went up to him and I started telling him my sad story. And Jerry goes, what's the big deal? God, group of drunks. And I just had such a, you know, I'd heard that saying before, but it didn't, you know, it didn't register that day. And so that was great. That was really good. And then in that same year, 2014, someone just called me up and said, do you want to go down to Santa Monica? There's going to be the first We Agnostic Atheist Freethinker Convention. And I said, sure. And we went down there, and Joe C was there. And it was like watching, AA to me had been watching it in black and white, and now it was in color. And it was just phenomenal. And I wish I'd been there the next day to hear Phyllis H speak, because she was the general service manager of Alcoholics Anonymous. And her speech is online. You can get it on, and it's really beautiful. The things she said about how this convention is one of the most important things that's ever happened in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's widening the movement, and believers have a place, and so do non-believers. And then in 2016. I was so fortunate because this guy had come up from Pasadena, which is 103 miles away from Santa Barbara, to start a We Agnostic meeting. And the two of us just hit it off so well. And we started with two people at this Unitarian church. And then we had four people. And it fluctuated in single digits. And just before COVID, we had 16 people in a small little room, you know, four each side had four people, and it was phenomenal. And I learned so much in that meeting. The camaraderie was so wonderful among us. Unfortunately, this person who drove, he had 12 years at the time, and he then started the Santa Barbara meeting on Zoom, and, it's one day at a time. Unfortunately, things happened in his life, and he found it necessary to drink again, and he hasn't come back to the meeting. It's been so upsetting to me. And, you know, I call him, he doesn't take my calls. Yeah, you know, there's no guarantees about the future in sobriety, that is for sure. I think I'm going to end with, you know, I wanted to go back to just, you know, there are a lot of super cool nuggets of wisdom in the big book. And today I can certainly take out, you know, this just for me, you know, this supernatural being that solves all your problems. But, you know, the simple sayings like, you know, the hunch or occasional inspiration gradually become a working part of the mind. That certainly has happened over the years. My sobriety date is June 1 of 87, and that's the date in my big book. I had another date, February 80, 1986, but I had to cross that one out because I started smoking weed one day at a time, and that didn't work for me. I tell people that, you know, with alcohol, definitely could have killed me physically. I mean, when I stopped drinking, I did not go to a rehab facility. I did it by myself in a room, and I had the delirium tremens. There were, you know, imaginary insects crawling up my arms that I was scratching. A good morning is when I could light a cigarette because I was shaking so much. And I really thought I'd lost my mind. I couldn't read. But, you know, slowly and surely, you get 30 days, you get 60 days. I got stronger, and a lot of my faculties came back, and they came back, you know, even better than before. With weed, it was very psychological. I mean, I used to look in on the carpet to find weed. I mean, I was an addict to the max, and I went to very dangerous places to get weed back in the 80s. It wasn't like it is today. Today you can just go down to dispensary and get 15 different kinds or whatever. I've never walked into one. I don't think I ever will. And, you know, it's, there's a sign in the Lano Club. Somebody had actually carved it out of wood, and it said, AA saved my life. Well, if I had carved that out of wood, I would just say AA gave me a life. Because from the age of 10 until the age of 20, sorry, not the age of 10, the age of 15 to the age of 25, for 10 years, I was just a walking chemical. I just wanted to change my state of mind. I wanted to feel good. I wanted a buzz. I wanted a high. And you know, unfortunately, those are the growing years. Those are the most important years in one's life, when one develops a character and values. And none of those were developed. They were developed later in AA, you know, in my 30s and early 40s. No question about it. So another line in the big book that really I try to live by, it's not easy in this day and age. You can read into that whatever you want. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Love and tolerance of other people. And, you know, when I came from South Africa, I was brought up racist. I was brought up homophobic. And because I met Black South Africans at UCLA, and I was the only white person in the South African Student Council, which had about 30, 35 members. And also because I met Black people in Alcoholics Anonymous, was I able to change? Was I able to transform and just to judge people as individuals and That is something I'll always be grateful for. And so I want to tell two quick stories and then I'm going to wrap it up. You know, I remember in early sobriety, I was, I was a believer, and I went to Ralph's. It's a grocery store I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I went there. I came home, didn't have my wallet, so I went back to the store. Nobody found it. It's not in the parking lot. I've lost my wallet. And so I'm doing like the third step prayer. And so I offer my wallet to thee, you know, to this imaginary God, whatever. And, you know, I was able to let it go. I mean, I used to lose things, and my mother used to beat me for losing stuff. And it's just part of being, I think I'm ADHD and being bipolar. So I lost the wallet, and about 2 hours, 3 hours later, the phone rings and this guy's on the phone. He goes, "Are you Jeff Taylor?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "I've got your wallet." And I said, "Hey man, you can keep the money. I just want my credit cards back. And there's a couple photos in there." And he goes, "No, don't worry, man. I'll give you everything. You'll get your wallet back." But he goes, "I see you have this little card in your wallet that, it's got the 12 steps, 12 traditions, serenity prayer on it." And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, I'm 17 days sober. Can you take me to a meeting?" And I took him to a meeting that night. And that was just very cool, you know, that happened. And the last story I'm just going to tell, which was really important in my life, was it's Wednesday at 6:30, the Santa Barbara meeting's going, and there's about six guys sitting in the meeting. And this woman walks in. She told us she was 25. I had a daughter at the time who was 25. I've got two daughters. Unfortunately, I'm divorced after a 30-year marriage, and that's a whole nother story. But so she walks into the meeting and she's got a backpack on, and she says, I'm from Baltimore, but I'm trying to come and get sober in Santa Barbara. I've got 4 days." And she sits down and she listens to the meeting, we agnostic atheist meeting. And after the meeting ended at 7:30. And after the meeting, she said to me, she came to me and she said, "But Jeff," she said, "I am a believer." And I said, "Well, then you need to go to a traditional meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "There's one that starts at the Alano Club. Do you want to go? Would you like me to take you over there?" And she goes, "Yeah." And on the way to the Alano Club, she says to me, "Are there going to be any women at this meeting?" Because she had just come to a meeting with six guys. And I said, "Yeah, there are going to be women at the meeting." And she goes, "I said, it's at the Alano Club." And so she goes, "Is there any drinking at the Alano Club?" And I said, no, there's no drinking at the Alano Club." So she went to the meeting, and it just so happened that somebody asked her to read How It Works. She got to share in the meeting. And after the meeting, she came up to me and she gave me a hug that was worth all the whiskey in the world. You know, I'm just I'm grateful that I could do that for her. So what I'm just trying to say is that, you know, what do they say? Different strokes for different folks. Whatever works, work it. I hope everybody in this room stays sober one day at a time. And I saw a bumper, not a bumper sticker. It's an actual license plate. In California, you can, I don't know if you can do this in other parts of the world, but you can create your own license plate. I've seen one which says "Great," and the A is an 8, grateful. Anyway, I saw this one and it says I, just four letters. It's actually three letters. IOAA. And that is basically the story of my life. Thanks for letting me share.